This is our birthday, so here's the toast.
We're proud of Monitor and we boast.
The years are showing, just look how we're growing on NBC.
Where this weekend, Monitor observes the start of its 14th year of service, with sincere thanks to all our loyal listeners. Brad Crandall here. News, views, and results in auto racing coming up later. About 3 minutes away, another opportunity to meet a millionaire. Now, renew a wonderful acquaintance with Mrs. Robinson. Of Simon and Garfunkel. Each weekend, Monitor affords you a close-up of one of America's wealthy men. This week's subject in the Meet a Millionaire spotlight springs from equal parts of scholar and athlete. To introduce him, Monitor reporter Candy Jones.
Our millionaire guest holds the Illinois State 220-yard low hurdle record. He's Robert McLeod, handsome publisher-editor of Teen Magazine. Former All-American halfback from Dartmouth and pro football player with the Chicago Bears. Bob has been publisher of Harper's Bazaar and 17 magazines. He writes teen fiction. He commutes to his offices from coast to coast, and he lives on the beach at Malibu, California. He's married, he has three sons, and he was a Marine Corps fighter pilot in World War II. Bob McLeod, were you born with a silver spoon in your mouth?
I think it was pretty close to my mouth, although I never really found it when I was young, I'll tell you that. Growing up and being a teenager in the depths of the Depression, the silver spoon was something we can talk about now, but at that moment it wasn't much of a reality, believe me.
As a teenager in high school, were you a good student?
Yes, I was. As I remember, my first year I was in high school, I was very poor. In fact, they had thoughts that I was never going to make it, but I was an honor student thereafter, and a reason I went to Dartmouth also was that I was the recipient of the first Chicago alumni scholarship that has been a regular thing since, and I'm very proud to have been the first recipient of it.
Which had been your stronger point, athletics or scholastics?
Well, I would say athletics, because they dominated my life at that moment, and the fact that pride in the fact that as an athlete I didn't want to be thought of as a dumb one. I'd like to be thought of, and I wanted to be thought of at the time, as being an athlete, but also have some scholastic ability, and I think that motivates you somewhat.
What one quality, now thinking back, helped you the most in making your fortune, your success?
I think competitive lust or verve, a high feeling of competition, of competitive instinct.
Now, does that track back right to your days up at Dartmouth as All-American halfback?
Yes, it does.
In sports?
Yes, mm-hmm. In sports. I think that if you have pride and you want to win, and you put everything that, and it sounds a little corny, I know, but if you put every attribute you have against your pride and say, well, I'm just not going to lose, you're going to make it.
Mm. With the name of McLeod, should I automatically assume that you are the thrifty Scots?
Absolutely. It's very difficult to save a quarter.
What's the greatest luxury you do allow yourself?
The greatest luxury that I have is, I think, editing and publishing the magazine from California, so that I can come back and forth across the country with regularity to New York and still be able to say that I'm a Californian, and still be able to get up and be on the beach in the morning, and to have the California activities whenever I want them.
So you've planned your business life very beautifully. How about in your personal life? In no way connected with business. Is there any one thing that you do which is your great personal present to yourself? A luxury?
Well, the luxury is to make absolutely sure that each week exercise prevails, and hopefully once a week at least a lunch hour whereby I can play a couple sets of tennis, because that's very precious to me, to get in that exercise. I think that you owe it to yourself, and you don't owe it to your company or your employees or your family or anyone else. That's the one very, very selfish thing that I want, is an hour and a half or 2 hours of exercise if I can get it during the week, but certainly then on weekends. And I don't want it to be interfered with by cocktail parties in the middle of the day or any other activity that takes me away from a real thing that I want to do for myself and for my body.
Mm-hmm. I have a final question, Bob McLeod. I know how busy you are. What is the greatest danger facing the younger generation? You deal with teenagers. Your whole magazine, Teen, is devoted to them. What do they face with danger ahead?
The greatest problem that we really have, I think, in this country in the teen level, is the problem of adequate and intelligent sex education. And this has been something that's been really pushed under the rug for a long time. It's only now beginning to break out. In this day of great, great thinkers and great educators, sex education has been so sadly neglected that it's unbelievable. Now, part of it's due to the fact that the parents and parent teachers associations resist the idea that anyone can help them in what they aren't doing at home. And when I say what they aren't doing, that's about the size of it. But mm-hmm. Sex education is a number one problem. Just the way driver education is a problem that's being solved with the help of industry, sex education isn't being solved, really. And it is just as much a destroyer of people, both boys and girls, as is, that is mentally as and spiritually as driver education is aimed at stopping carnage on the highway.
Exactly. Well, I hope that a lot of parents listen to that and take heed from your advice there, as well as teenagers. Thank you so much for being with us. We've been talking with millionaire publisher editor of Teen Magazine, Robert McLeod. This is Candy Jones for Monitor.
Chris Economaki brings us up to date on what's happening in auto racing shortly, so stay right here on the Monitor Beacon. Thank you. at 14 minutes before the hour. Miss Lana Cantrell, one of her latest.
An angry silence lay where love had been, and in your eyes a look I've never seen. If I had found the words, you might have stayed, but as I turned to speak, the music played. As you took her hand, the music played. Across the to let my heart control my head, but I was made to see the price I paid, and as she held you close, the music played.
Monitor presents Sport of Speed. It's time for your weekend checkpoint with Chris Economaki, with action from the world of auto racing. Brought to you by the refiners of world-famous Pennsylvania-grade crude oils. Chris will be along in just a moment. But first of all, let me ask you a question that people quite often ask us. What's so great about Pennsylvania-grade crude motor oils? All right. Let's put it this way. Some oils take several days to produce. Pennsylvania crudes took a million years. Nature has never produced a crude oil like it. Pennsylvania crudes have a unique molecular structure that stands up to the heat of high speeds. Can you imagine what happens to lesser oils when they're thrashed around several thousand times a minute at turnpike speeds? Pennsylvania-grade crude motor oils never get so stirred up that they forget what they're supposed to do. So for the good of your engine, insist on Pennsylvania-grade crude motor oils. And by the way, all of you sports car enthusiasts, when is your club holding its next rally? You can get a complete rally kit with checkpoint signs, windshield numbers, and sanctioned scoring slips from the Pennsylvania-grade Crude Oil Association. For just $1, you get six big checkpoint signs, windshield stickers numbered 1 through 100, and a pad of 120 rally scoring slips. Send your dollar to Checkpoint, Box 96, Oil City, Pennsylvania, zip code 16301. Now, here's Chris Economaki.
Thanks, Mel. The factories had a disappointing day today at the Carolina Motor Speedway in Rockingham, as only two of 15 factory-backed cars finished the NASCAR Carolina 500. The Allison brothers, Donnie in a factory Ford and Bobby in his own Chevelle, ran 1-2 in the race, which attracted a record crowd of 52,000. Third went to Dodge factory driver James Hilton, with the Independents taking the rest of the prize money. Richard Brickhouse, in his very first automobile race, was fourth in a Plymouth, and fifth went to Roy Tyner in his Ford. Jabe Thomas, Ford, J.C. McDuffie, Buick, John Sears and Clyde Lennon, Fords, along with Dave Marsis in a Chevelle, rounded out the top 10. It was 95 degrees in the stands and 145 degrees on the track surface as engine failure, mechanical trouble, and tangles sidelined 13 factory cars. The intense heat made relief driving a rule rather than the exception in the race, which had 20 lead changes among five drivers. In USAC stock car race today at New Bremen, Ohio, Ford factory ace Jack Bowser won both 50-mile events, beating Gene Marmer, Norm Nelson, and Frank Frieda in the first race, and Al Unser, Marmer, and champion Don White in the nightcap. The second race was interrupted for over an hour when Bill Bailing of Milwaukee spun into the pits and clobbered a wrecker. The track doctor, watching the action from atop the wrecker, fell off and suffered a broken arm and joined Bailing, his leg injured, in the hospital. The delay was made necessary while another doctor was rounded up. At Lexington, Ohio, in today's three-hour Trans-American Sedan Championship race at Mid-Ohio Raceways, Mark Donahue, who started last, placed his Penske Camaro a lap and a half ahead at the finish of Jerry Titus's Mustang, Peter Revson's Javelin, and Bob Johnson's Camaro. Fifth and first under 2 liters was Burt Everett's Porsche 911. Young Gary Bettenhausen gained his first sprint car victory today at Terre Haute, Indiana, outrunning Scratch Daniels, Raleigh Beal, Sam Sessions, and Carl Williams in the Land of Lincoln 50-lapper. Gary's victory ended the six-race winning streak of Larry Dixon, who spun out while in sixth place. Yesterday afternoon, at Mosport Park Road Course in Ontario, Dan Gurney again showed that his Gurney Eagle is the best road racing machine on the USAC Championship Trail, and that he's equally superior behind the wheel. Mario Andretti chased Dan home in both of the 100-mile heats, with Roger McCluskey third in the opener, and Ronnie Bucknam in the show spot second time around. Indy winner Bobby Unser destroyed his Rislone Eagle and suffered a cut forehead when he spun off the road early in the first race. And Gordon Johncock peeled the wheels off his Eagle when he came around a blind turn and found a local driver motoring at 20 miles an hour. He was unhurt. There's lots of work to be done on the many damaged cars this week, prepping for the Langhundred 150-miler in Pennsylvania next Sunday. This is Chris Economaki reporting.
Sport of Speed, brought to you twice each weekend by the many famous brands of Pennsylvania-grade crude oil. For the lasting good of your engine, insist on a Pennsylvania motor oil. This is Mel Allen for Monitor Sports.
Sport of Speed is a regular feature every weekend on Monitor.
When the lights went out, were you only a dream that I only dreamed about? Where was I when the lights went out? Was I only the flame you knew you could do without? Was my heart just dying to tie one on? Why did I try to tag along? Was it only a slip, just a trip, but not a fall? Was that all it was meant to be? Were my eyes just deceiving me? Was the light all that blinded me? Or was it you who couldn't see?
And that one is new from the Letterman.
In the 1900s, cigarettes were considered so new that we used an average of only 2 packs per person a year. By 1930, that figure rose to 70, and scientists soon became suspicious of cigarettes as a possible health problem. In the 50s, research was going on, both in this country and abroad. By 1962, the average per capita consumption of cigarettes reached 200 packs a year. Something had to be done. One of the reasons for concern is the great increase in lung cancer. In the United States alone, lung cancer deaths have increased from 3,000 in 1930 to 50,000 in 1965. Facts are facts. You can't argue with a fact. You can't ignore it. Or can you? Write for the newest free booklet, Facts About Smoking and Health, U.S. Public Health Service, Washington, D.C., 20201.
The latest from Caravelli's orchestra, Delilah. The latest around the nation and the world is directly ahead, so stay close by for NBC Monitor News on the hour. Brad Crandall here.
Though we must take a station break, don't turn your set off, don't you make a mistake. Don't leave us behind, there's still lots more time with Monitor.
This is our birthday, so here's the toast.
We're proud of Monitor and we boast.
30 years are showing, just look how we're growing on NBC.
Where we are celebrating our 13th Monitor birthday in the beginning of year number 14, with many thanks to you. Brad Crandall here, and just a few minutes away, Mel Allen reporting all of today's action in sports. First, a sport named Glenn Yarborough.
I left my home, left my job, left my friend. Set out to roam, out beyond where the highway ends. I'd never seen the sea or looked at a starry sky until you happened to pass by. I was so sure nothing troubled my mind. Safe and secure, thought I'd found all there was to find. Living from day to day without ever knowing why. Until then the sound of you sang in my ear, and the sight of you dazzled my eyes, and the warmth
blue, where the stars never lose their shine. You are my everything, my earth, my sea, my sky. So glad you happen to pass by.
At the Monitor Sports Desk now, Mel Allen with Today in Sports.
Thank you very much, Brad. Hello there, everybody. Lee Trevino, keep the name in mind, was just a $30 a week driving range assistant pro a year ago. Today, Lee Trevino is the U.S. Open champion and $30,000 richer. He won his first tournament by four strokes. That's the incredible rags-to-riches story of Mexican-American Lee Trevino, a 28-year-old gravedigger's grandson who's a blithe spirit along the lines of, well, of Tony Lima. And he ordered a tequila party for the press to celebrate his victory. Trevino started the day one stroke behind leader Bert Yancey. He made the turn one stroke ahead and then applied the knockout on 11 and 12, sinking birdie putts of 35 and 20 feet. Trevino finished with a 69 for a tournament record, tying record, I should say, of 275, and in the process became the first man in Open history to post four subpar rounds. The first three were 69, 68, and 69. With Bert Yancey collapsing with a 76 and a 281 for third, defending champion Jack Nicklaus made a charge and finished second with a 279 on a 67. Nicklaus posted the 275 tournament record in winning last year. Trevino, getting back to the winner, was born in Dallas and lived with his grandfather after his parents separated. He quit school in the eighth grade and earned his keep shining shoes and caddying. He joined the Marines and then returned to golf. Last year, he was an assistant pro at a driving range in El Paso when his wife persuaded him to qualify for the Open. He did, finished a surprising fifth, and his tournament career was launched. On the Monitor Baseball scoreboard in the National League, St. Louis beat Cincinnati 4-2. Ray Washburn beat George Culver. Atlanta beat Chicago 1-0, 11 innings. Jim Britton beat Chuck Hartenstein. Los Angeles beat Philadelphia 2-1. Claude Osteen, the winning pitcher, and Rick Wise, the loser. This was Bob Skinner's debut as Phil's manager. Rick Wise homered in his behalf for Philadelphia. The Giants and Mets split in the first game of a doubleheader. San Francisco beat the Mets 4-1. Ray Sadecki, the winning pitcher, and Dick Selma, the loser. Jack Hyde hit a home run for the Giants, so did Willie Mays. It was Mays' 12th of the season and career number 576. Cleon Jones homered for the Mets. In the second game, New York beat the San Francisco Giants 3-1. Danny Frisella beating Bill Henry. Art Shamsky of the Mets hit a home run, and the Mets drew a crowd of almost 55,000 to Shea Stadium for the doubleheader. The Pirates swept the Astros in the first game of doubleheader. It was 3-1, Steve Blass beating Mike Cuellar. Mike Cuellar homered for Houston. And in the second game, Pittsburgh won it 11-2, Tommy Sisk the winning pitcher and Larry Dericker the losing pitcher. Jim Wynn homered for the Astros. In the American League, the White Sox and Tigers split. Chicago won the first game 3-2. Hoyt Wilhelm beat Mickey Lolich. Tommy Davis homered for the White Sox. And in the second game, 6-1, Denny McClain beating Cisco Carlos. Boston took Cleveland 5-3. Bill Landis in relief of Jim Lomborg, who made his first start since the World Series and gave up only three singles in five innings. Mike Paul was the losing pitcher. Rico Petrocelli and Ken Harrelson homered for Boston. Minnesota beat Washington 4-2. Dave Boswell beat Jim Hannon. Cesar Tovar for the Twins and Ron Hansen for the Senators hit home runs. Senators have now lost five in a row. The Yankees beat California 4-3. Fritz Peterson beat Ricky Clark. Horace Clark and Mickey Mantle homered for the Yankees. Mantle's ninth of the year, career number 527. Rick Reichardt homered for the Angels. And Oakland beat Baltimore 4-2. Chuck Dobson beat Pete Rickard. Mike Hershberger homered for the A's, and Fred Valentine and Kurt Bleffrey for the Orioles. That's what is and will be in sports, Brad. Mel Allen here, friends, reminding you that for more features and news from the world of sports, stay tuned to Monitor.
Thank you, Mel.
Stay right here on NBC.
Where you'll meet the author of a new book on the Vietnam War, a book that spells out the destruction and the irony of the struggle. So stay on the Monitor Beacon. You're back with Monitor at 17 minutes after the hour. The next voice you'll hear belongs to pretty Vicky Carr.
Don't break my pretty bone. If I want to be a dreamer, let me. Don't break my pretty balloon. Don't say he doesn't love me. If I want to believe he loves me, let me think what I want to. I'm the one who needs him, not you. Don't break my pretty balloon. If I want to be a dreamer, let me. Don't tell me he's been cheating, and about all the girls he's meeting, I wanna think he's mine alone. So go away and leave me alone. Don't break my pretty balloon. If I wanna be a dreamer, let me. Cause I love him so, and I only know, with him life's clover, without him it's over. So don't break my pretty balloon. If I wanna be a dreamer, let me. Don't break my pretty balloon.
A brief word now about the National Multiple Sclerosis Campaign. MS, multiple sclerosis, is the great crippler of young adults. MS can mean long years of increasing disability, often eventual paralysis. There's no cure yet, but there is hope for a cure through research. The National Multiple Sclerosis Society asks your help. Give generously to the MS volunteer. The agony and frustration of the Vietnam War has been graphically documented in a new book by 24-year-old author Jonathan Schell, titled The Military Half. It's an eyewitness account of the destruction the war has brought to two provinces in South Vietnam. NBC correspondent Howard Tuckner, formerly stationed in Vietnam, talks with Mr. Schell about some of the specific points raised by the book.
Mr. Schell, your book says that many civilians died because of United States military operations in the two provinces, Quang Nai and Quang Tin. Why did this happen? Weren't the civilians warned to leave the areas?
Well, it happened in a hundred different ways. In some cases, they are warned to leave, but in other cases, they aren't warned, particularly when troops are fighting with the enemy nearby. So that if there's a sniper fire from a village, they call in what they call an immediate strike. which means that the planes come right in as soon as they can with the bombs. And in that case, there's almost very rarely enough time to give any kind of warning. And even in the cases when they do give a warning, it's given by leaflets. And unfortunately, many of the Vietnamese peasants can't read, so these leaflets are extremely ineffective.
You mean the leaflets that are written in Vietnamese, they can't read Vietnamese either?
They can't read Vietnamese either. But there, a lot of them are illiterate, of course, having never gone to school. And also, even sometimes when they get the leaflet and understand it, they prefer to stay within a large area simply because they don't know what awaits them. They've heard terrible stories of what happens when they get to the camps, and many of these stories are true, that there's no kind of viable life for them there, and they prefer to take their chances with the bombs.
A lot of people can't seem to understand why the Americans are having so much trouble. They say, well, you've got jet planes, which the Viet Cong does not have in South Vietnam. You've got heavy artillery, which in many areas of South Vietnam, the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese do not have. They can't seem to understand that two snipers, two guerrillas, can keep down an American company for a while, and that the Americans answer with artillery and air power, which destroys villages. What have you found in your experience?
Yeah. Well, the problem isn't that our soldiers aren't fighting hard or that our firepower isn't great enough. Because certainly whenever we meet with enemy forces, our troops probably, in military terms, acquit themselves very well. The problem is that in doing so, what the officials call the side effects really can be seen as the main effects of the war. For example, when you bomb a village, the people of that village learn to hate America and to hate the government that we support there, if they don't already. And when you proceed to take all the people from that village, the survivors, to a camp of some kind, well, the soldiers often find that there are no men in the village. Well, where did they go? They went to join the Viet Cong. So in a way, even though we may acquit ourselves well in each individual military encounter, the overall effect would seem to be to actually strengthen the enemy by arousing hostility against us.
What about the refugees you speak about? Yeah, are they being treated properly? Are they getting the USAID money and the South Vietnamese government money that they're supposed to be getting? Are the province chiefs padding the refugee lists from what you've determined?
For one thing, all transportation in Vietnam is on our side is now done by air. And, of course, the military requirements get top priority. And when you're trying to supply a population of dispossessed people who now number about 4 million, I guess, with food, that's an incredible amount of air transportation, and we just don't have it, that's all. We just don't have that. It's, what, 6 Berlin airlifts wouldn't do the job. And these people are not just people who have no food. They're people who have no houses, who have no jobs, families that have been split, families without men. So the problem is just enormous.
Mr. Schell, in your opinion, with what you've seen in Vietnam and what you've written about, do you feel American forces should be in Vietnam?
Well, if I can leave aside for the moment the international consequences of our presence there, I would say that we are far from saving the Vietnamese people and far from setting up a decent government there. We are destroying their villages and their society and really only keeping in power a group of men who never would have seen power had we not come into Vietnam in the first place.
Thank you. Jonathan Schell, author of a new no-nonsense book on the destruction in Vietnam. It's called The Military Half. This is Howard Tuckner, NBC News, reporting for Monitor.
Burt Bacharach's orchestra, Are You There? Monitors everywhere. Available all over America on NBC Radio. WPTF Raleigh, North Carolina is NBC for Eastern Carolina. Monitor continues shortly with the award-winning NBC News program, The World and Washington, an in-depth look at the United States' role in world affairs. This is Brad Crandall.
This is David Weber, NBC News, Paris. Listen to comprehensive coverage of the Paris Peace Talks on NBC Radio.